Welcome to Get Moving TV. I'm Dr. Chris Landon, and I serve as your host. Here in Ventura County, again, there's just unearthed rare people and programs going on. I'm lucky enough to have become acquainted with a Ventura County-based one called Sum of All Music. With this, it started out as a breakfast club in Calabasas. There's one in Malibu as well. And they'll have Malibu want to have Bob Saget on, and the Muppets on, just all kinds of crazy things, really things to get the musicians and composers thinking. Sum of All Music has really oriented itself now towards providing the United Nations and other independent filmmakers with film scores. So I get the advantage of being around people who really do know what music is all about. I've been lucky enough to participate in one of the film composing, but they always have somebody behind me. It's like being a high wire act and having a very nice net underneath, which is our guest today. It's Jeff Carruthers. Jeff, we're going to talk about your career and all kinds of things today. So how did you get involved with Sum of All Music?
Well, you mentioned the Malibu one, so I had attended that a few times. And then when the pandemic hit, no one was going, but a couple friends of mine that had known about the Agora or Calabasas chapter of it told me about it. And so I dialed on in a couple of years ago. I think this is about the second year we've been in the pandemic about now. So that's how I got involved. And I spoke with Joseph Metcalf, who's the moderator of the group, and told him that I had been in the record business for a long time, but looking to meet more people to network toward film and TV, and because I'd like doing cues and soundtrack.
So cues and soundtrack, and there are all these send me your wave files, and there are all these new technology vocabulary I had to learn for yourself. So how did you start in music? When you were a football player, you went to a hot rodder, or what did you end up doing in high school?
I learned how to play guitar in junior high school. Yeah. And I had actually started on piano when I was a little kid. My grandfather, he was the conductor when they used to have live music on radio shows back in the 30s in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And he worked his way out to Hollywood to get into writing for the movies, which he did. And I started taking piano lessons from him when I was 5 or 6 years old. And I did that till I was about 10. And then, as you just said, I wanted to get out there with the other kids, and I didn't want to be practicing after school and all the kids were out playing, so I put the piano down for a little while. But just a few years later, I got interested in guitar because the Beatles and a lot of the groups you were seeing on TV and hearing on the radio, all guitar bands. And so I got into playing guitar and went from there.
Well, and there's the chicks and all that.
Yeah, and you know, when you're 11 years old, that's what you're thinking about. You know, you want to be a guitar god.
Yes. Well, and you are a guitar god now, which we'll get to that. So here you are, you're in junior high school, and I had a friend who's a pediatrician, and his son plays cello. And my daughter had taken her piano lessons for a year and then just stopped. And I said, well, you know, Myron, how did you get him to, you know, continue? Because he said, $5. I go, I'm sorry, I don't recognize that word, $5. He said, I would pay him $5 every time he sat at the piano. Oh. So 5 years, you must have been a wealthy wealthy young man. So here you are, you're in junior high school, now you're in high school. Did you join band? I mean, how did you progress in your skills and your understanding? I mean, starting piano, of course, that.
Of course, I took lessons at the local music store and learned how to play, you know, the basic chords up and down the neck and, you know, practice scales and whatnot. But, of course, you know, there are older guys teaching you not what I want to play. right? Yes. So I am going after school now, and I'm what they call dropping the needle on a vinyl record player. And back then you could slow it down to 16 RPM, right? So here I am learning the guitar solos from Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix, and basically learning how to play rock lead guitar. And once kind of getting, you know, a few riffs under my hands, I'm meeting some friends at school, and of course we put the old famous garage band together. And the next thing you know, we're playing high school dances, and we have a picture of me playing here that we can put up.
And okay. And with the long hair and back and forth, we watch Evan with Exit 15 from Sum of All Music, and he's got that rock thing down. He's playing at the Canyon Club. So you got all your moves down too? Or
so you know, probably, but mostly just playing the songs we liked as kids of the day, and you know, we were good enough that all the high schools wanted us to play their sock hops. We're playing all the dances and. And then we started playing some of these private parties and casuals, you'd call them. And that was like kind of the high school years. And then when I got into college, then I had really only one choice but to study classical guitar, because back in the 70s, that's what the curriculum was for guitar players. They did have jazz band, but there wasn't really anybody teaching you jazz or rock, or there was no recording curriculum. It was pretty much you just had to, you know, be in the classical guitar department. So I did that for, you know, the 4 years that I was in college getting my bachelor's degree.
So now we have, what, Musicians Institute, USC, yeah. You've got, so life might have been a little different, but you're a smooth jazz god,
that's a lot later on. Yeah. That's a lot later on. I mean,
so what was that journey? It's an arc of life here.
Okay, so I can go through it pretty quickly. So, you know, during college, of course, on the outside, I'm taking lessons from jazz guitar players because now I'm hearing George Benson, and I'm hearing some of these guys that are crossing over into, you know, popular music, right? So I want to learn how to do all that too. Okay, so I'm learning a lot more about the instrument and listening to a lot more pop music along the way. And now I'm about to graduate college, and I'm thinking about, okay, so what am I going to do to make a living? And get myself into a group and start playing and making some money, you know, while I still keep getting better at what I do. Now I'm getting into the club years of, you know, my evolution. So for a good 10 or 12 years now, I'm in the club circuit and playing in California and throughout the Southwest, and playing in everything from pretty big nightclubs to hotel nightclubs, and that was a big evolution of really understanding pop music, because when you're playing in nightclubs, you're pretty much playing cover songs of what is the hit of the day, top 40 cover band. So I did that for a really long time, and listened still very intently. There's no YouTube back then. There was nobody to show you, here's how you play the song. You had to listen to either a vinyl record, or, you know, when cassettes finally came out, and you had to just focus in on what your part was and really hear it. So along with that, you're hearing just the makeup of how they put these songs together, and kind of hear why are these songs in the top 40 on Billboard in the first place. So at one of my last top 40 club gigs, where I was in a house band that played in Studio City for quite a few years, a production company came in. Maybe they happened to come in. I think they were actually looking at one of our lead singers. We always had a female lead. And they started talking to me, and at that time I had also, now we're into the 80s, I had really been interested in digital instruments. So I had, you know, one of the first drum machines and sequencers and digital keyboards. So And I still had some keyboard skills enough to, you know, I knew what the notes were on the keyboard, you know. And so they needed someone to run their sequencers for them and hired me to be that guy, right? Well, in the meantime, I have these demos I'm recording on cassettes. One of the guys hears one of my demos. He goes, I kind of like that. Let me write something to it. That song ends up going on a group on Motown, a young group, and became a platinum record. So I quit the nightclub band and stayed into the recording studio and production side of music pretty much ever since then.
So piano, junior high school, college, 10 years or however long in the
nightclubs.
Clubs before, and then you regenerated or evolved into the next.
Yeah, and so now I'm in studios with the big mixing consoles and the 2-inch tape machines. And now, as a songwriter and arranger, I'm kind of coming in there, bringing all my keyboards and drum machines and setting all that up. And back then, we'd lay a track of Sympty to one of the 24 track, and then they'd play that back, and we'd sync everything up and lay it all down, and they'd make a bounce of that and have another, put up another 24 track. And at this point, I might be going home. If that was my involvement in the project, but then singers would come in with, you know, that the production company had got a contract through with other whatever record company, and we worked a lot with Motown and MCA, and mostly all the record companies, A&M and whoever was in town at that time, and we'd do the vocals, and. I got my first production through this company that I was working with, and we kind of went off and got a side deal with a singer that I was working with, and that was kind of one of the first records that I produced in 1988 on my own.
Well, that's pretty.
Yeah, and that was on. It ended up being on A&M. And it kind of was a regional success. It did kind of well in the South. And I think we did a cover of Bill Withers' song. And so that was the one that they put out because it was recognizable.
So where did things go? So now you're independent producer,
yeah,
recording.
So you've got all there, this background. From there, that's kind of when I got into the smooth jazz genre. I had been writing all these R&B tunes on these tracks, and I'd have singers come to my studio. I had a studio for a while on Wilshire Boulevard in the La Brea Arts District, and it was in a office building. So after hours, after everyone else had gone and, you know, left for the day, I'd show up at 5 o'clock and go to work. So I was on the opposite side of everybody else, so that I wouldn't bother anybody, of course, right? So I had artists that I was working with come over, and I'm, of course, trying to get songs placed on different labels, you know, through my connections from the production company that I'd worked with. And I had met an engineer that recorded one of these records that I had done that I had to deal with. And he said, I'm producing an artist on a little label, and it's all instrumental, and it's a saxophone player. And he said, do you have any songs that you want to put on this guy's record? And I said, well, why don't you listen to a couple things here that haven't gone anywhere yet? And so we put it together and took the vocalists off these songs, had the player just kind of do the melodies that he had heard with saxophone instead. And so this guy turned out to be Boney James, who ended up being very popular to this day in the smooth jazz scene. And that was his first record, pretty much, was mostly my songs that we kind of reformulated into the smooth jazz genre, which is kind of a combination of instrumental, jazzy melodies over top of R&B music beds.
So just can you explain just a little, so you're rock, so how is rock constructed, and then you moved on to the club, how is that constructed, and then smooth jazz is constructed a different way, so it's a matter of the chords.
It's just a different style, mm-hmm. I mean.
So it's a different tempo, different notes, different instruments.
I mean, to me, I can do whatever kind of music, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. and so rock is just the instruments that you choose and the attitude you play it with, you know? And so smooth jazz is kind of the same way. It's just the instruments you choose and the attitude and the background you play it, where you're coming from. You know, I guess I could break it down further and say pentatonic scales has a lot to do with rock music, and in jazz there's a little bit more, you know, flavor as far as musicianship, only in the sense of the knowledge of scales on your instrument, but not in the sense of performance-wise. I mean, you know, the Eddie Van Halens and the great rock guitar players from our day that, you know, played mostly pentatonic scales, though, but their techniques are incomparable, yeah. and are just as good as any of the greatest musicians that ever lived, right?
Well, I was telling you earlier, my first recording was at age 4, my dad had worked for Hill & Range Publishing, which is sheet music, which people don't know about. This was records, and they didn't have jackets on them, and he was a writer, so he wrote the liner notes, started liner notes. And so they sent him down to Memphis, Tennessee, and they dragged me along. And the day after we did something, we went in this little studio, maybe the size of this stage. It had little pony walls, and the vice president of RCA, Victor Records, was there, and he was assigned to calm me down at age 4. So I had this box of paper clips, and I was making paperclip necklaces and bracelets and everything. And the engineer, I remember there's this one mic, I think it was probably a giant Sennheiser mic in the center of the room. And he had to have the guitar player, the rhythm guitar was at a certain, the vocalist, and then all he had was a snare drum, so it wouldn't overcome things. Stand-up bass, and I remember the lead guitar player was stabbing his speakers with a Bic pen to get a different sound from what the speakers were showing. So I'm 4. This is great stuff, and I'm. So they start recording, and it's recording one. The engineer, oh no, we got about moves people around the room. Oh, recording two, moves people around the room, and so 18 takes, and I've run out of paper clips. Steve Scholz freaks out. Gets me a yellow pad with a ruler and a pencil, and I'm 4, and I'm making lines, the straightest lines ever. And somewhere around take 19, 20, I've got my ruler, and I'm just tapping away in the background. And somewhere around take 28, they stopped. And the engineer said, okay. I think it was around take 19, 20, plays it back. And it said, I think a Nakamichi tape recorder smuggled in from Japan, because we'd just been at war with Japan. This would be 1955. Oh, wow. And shakes it. Still that sounds, cleans the head, still the sound is there. So the first release of Johnny Cash's I Walk the Line, I got my little ruler in the background.
So that was you in the background?
That was me in the background. But since I've lost all sense of rhythm and time and all that, it's very adventurous. So,
now we have, you know, time correct abilities and Pro Tools and would have fixed it right up.
Yeah, auto-tune and everything else. I mean, I could sound good.
Auto-tune
no,
that paper
I don't
clip.
Think so. Yeah. Yeah. So what do you use for mics now? And you have a digital library of your own, I think.
Well, I have a library that's for sale, yeah, mm-hmm. through a distributor called Big Fish Audio. Mm-hmm. And these libraries contain different styles of music that I've done. Some by myself, some with other people. Everything from flamenco to smooth jazz to rock to 70s funk and to cinematic and sound design. Instruments that can be loaded into Kontakt, which is, you know, a product that you can put into your DAW, your digital audio workstation. Bring up all these different styles of music to incorporate into your own productions.
So good or bad?
In what sense?
So I have a friend, Mike Malloy. He works in radiology because he knows everything there is to know about computers. And so in terms of digital management of computerized x-rays, he's great. But he also did film composing for National Geographic and the like. And he has the Vienna Symphony Orchestra, every single note played with a live instrument.
Right.
So is your library
like? It's like, yes, yeah. Every single note is played by a live instrument. And in all these different styles. So all the guitars I played or the people that I work with played. The drums are all live played. I've mixed everything so you can use my mixes or you can pull it apart. We also, in the product, everything is broken out into what we call stems. So you can have each individual instrument, you know, right down to just individual drums too. And incorporate that into your own project, or put it together your own way.
Well, as you know, we had this project with Taylor's Embroidery, the Ethiopian project, and Jeff Gross, who was supposed to help me out, drops out, and so I go, okay, well, I don't really know how to do much of anything. Let me play with this, and I have a 15-year-old kid who I've known for a long time, who picked up the ney, and that being one of the native instruments, and. And so we put something together, and your eyes didn't roll all the way back in your head, but it was pretty obvious that we were not on the mark, but could improve and be improved by someone who really knew what they were doing. And he went back to his instructor, and he said, "Oh, Jeff Carruthers wants his notes," and he said, "Well, he's given you the notes are in a fa ne, and you have a so ne." And you said, one of the worst puns ever, thank you, Dad, there is somebody worse than you. Oh, mine was a phone, F-A-U-X. So, yeah.
So a phone, yeah. F-A-U-X, nay.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I a friend who's since passed, Handy Nasser, who's a hand drummer, and he would go to the centers of the world to earthquake sites, whatever, and would put together live sounds because he felt these electronic drum machines, your old Roland and the like, just weren't human.
No.
That the beat of the human heart is not, it's irregular as it goes. I played with David Lindley, all these. He'd come to my house and I go, "But Handy, play." He goes, "No, you play." I go, "Well, I don't play or sing." He goes, "Well, you play or sing. This is your opportunity." So when Soam came up, that was good. So that human variation that occurs, can you do that with your digital library? Do you feel human, or is it just?
Well, like I said, all the parts in the library were all played by humans.
Yes.
So every performance that you would download was played by someone. There's nothing that was done and then, quantized. I guess what I'm saying is that a lot of times we'll fix performances, even from humans. You have to fix performances. People's timing, musicians' timing isn't always perfect. Now, you don't want it to be perfect because then that takes the human quality out of it. However, you don't want it to be so imperfect that, you know, we need to call in another drummer, right? So you can take what you have and you can fix it, you know, enough where just the rough spots are smoothed out. And that's how all the stuff is that I work with. And, emphasize on what you're talking about with the Taylor Embroidery project that I helped you with, the faux ney that I used was actually a real ney player, but they're pre-recorded performances that I picked out to use in ours. So they didn't have the inspiration from a real musician listening to what we made and reacting to it. Their inspiration from me grabbing what I thought would work for the piece that I had from what you had suggested to me.
Yes. Well, and plus you're looking at the scene and you're watching her move through the scene and how can you propel that along with...
Yes, that's true. So we're looking at a video, you know, a movie that we were asked to do the music for. And this particular cue, we're watching the reactions of the people that are interacting. We're listening to the pitch and tone of their voice and hearing their emotions. And we're looking at just the scenery that it was cut in too, and making our decisions as to what the music should be to emphasize what we're seeing on the screen to help propel it along.
Yeah, and with native instruments to Ethiopia as best we could.
Yep.
You know, just when I look at the French, you know, black and white films, there's always a jazz. I mean, that's where some of the best jazz was accompanying
or
them.
Or an accordion or something, yeah.
You know, a gentleman knows how to play the accordion and knows not to play it. Yeah. Now that in this part of your career, I've interviewed, Michael McDonald and Willie Ornelas and Maitland Ward, we were talking about, and every single one of them is as you and I are, which is we want to look at each other in the eyes because we're not hearing as well after all those years of of that. So, where do you see things going? In terms of recording? I mean, now that you're paid 0.00001 cent per...
There's a couple of subjects there. The monetization part that you just ended there with, that's getting better. And I see that in the future getting better yet. And I see musicians getting paid more for the streams. As far as music in general, the libraries I do, that's a sideline to my actual recordings that I get out and, you know, still get to radio and streaming platforms. I'll make a plug for myself right now. I have one coming out in a couple of weeks on January 31st. It's called Back in the Sun, and it's from a client of mine that I worked with called Janice Lacey. The album is called Catalina, which also was the first single that was released last year in June. And this one is another smooth jazz song, and it features a friend of mine on tenor sax, Eden Perez from Rio Grande, Texas. And that can bring me to another subject about recording remotely, which is going into the future of music. I see this happening more and more, especially with the COVID epidemic. A lot of us have been recording remotely, and we'll complete our part, send it to the next person or a friend of ours that's another musician that we want to perform on what we're doing. They'll do that, send it back. Of course, there's some collaboration along the way, getting what you want so that there's not a lot of, okay, well, I didn't hear that, so do it again. At any rate, I see a lot of remote recording happening in the future. And as the technology improves, a lot of that simultaneously happening. I know that they can do that now. You know, we've seen the sessions that have taken place in Los Angeles and London at the same time with some famous people. But I think it's going to be more on an everyday basis going forward, where they'll just be able to arrange a time, everybody logs on, and they've got their studio and their microphones and their setup, and the drummer counts it off, and we have a live session, and we do a few takes, and then all those tracks can be all stemmed out and edited by whoever's going to mix that later on. And I also see just the digital replications of analog gear continually getting better and better and better. And I'm always upgrading my stuff. You know, we talked in the hallway just now about always having to do the latest OS, the latest computers, so that you can have the latest and greatest stuff to work with and, you know, make the best possible music you can.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much. Thank him for making the best possible music. Ventura, we have a lot of local resources, incredible town, but also we look to the future. How are you going to be making music? How are you going to be working with internationally? So Ventura, it's time for you to get moving.
And cut.